Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast. Dr. Junie McKenzie qualified in general medicine in Manchester. She obtained the diploma in psychological medicine in 1976 and undertook the psychiatric rotation both in child and adolescent psychiatry and forensic psychiatry prior to setting up the first therapeutic community for young offenders in HM Young Offender Institution, Glen Parver. She also worked in TCs at HMP Grendon, Gartree and Dovegate, as well as 14 other prisons and two regional secure units. She is also trained as a psychotherapist and has been a practicing therapist and supervisor since her retirement from institutional and managerial positions. Her married name is Judy Isaac.
Thank you very much for asking me. A privilege to be here.
Very good to see you, Judy.
You too, David.
Hi, Judy. It's really nice to meet you, and thank you very much for joining us today.
So, Judy, you trained in medicine in Manchester. Is that your hometown?
That's right.
Yeah?
Absolutely not. No, I'm a Scot, but I have worked all my life in England, I suppose, all my working life in England. I just think it's my duty to bring civilization to those south of the border. So I've stayed down there.
You did, and that's where I first met you, of course, in good old Berkshire, I think it is. Bucks. You were telling us, Judy, how you managed to find your way down south and work most of your career in England.
Yes.
But how did you make the decision to get into psychiatry and therapeutic communities?
Well, I was talking about this with somebody else the other day. I think basically I'm a gossip. And even when I was a student on the medical wards, I remember my registrar. You know how you have to present cases? Every discipline presents cases. And we were supposed to give signs and symptoms and the rest of it and then a nice, good history. And I started saying about how this poor chap was impacted in his job and with his family and the rest of it by his condition. And the registrar just went, oh, my God, you ought to write for Woman's Own. And that was his verdict on my career. And I think it's been true ever since. I'm a storyteller. I like people's stories. And that's why I prefer psychotherapy, I suppose, to clinical psychiatry. And that's how I got into the therapeutic communities side of things, because I was lucky enough to have a placement with youngsters in the NHS. And that was just suddenly discovering how it could be instead of the cold clinical side of clinical medicine.
So that was right at the beginning of your...
Right at the very beginning, yes. And I was working in the young people's unit in Macclesfield. We were visited by an extraordinary woman called Mary Ellis, who was the senior medical officer, yes, in Felton Borstal. And I was just amazed by what they were doing. I suppose the other thing that happened was that I realised that because we had youngsters, all the people who were there had been convicted of some kind of an offence, but because their family had money, they came to the NHS and had therapy. Whereas if they came from the back streets and were poor, they were shipped off to Borstal. And so I decided to go and see what was going on in Borstal. And that's how I got into the prison service. And then from that, therapeutic communities in prisons.
So did you say that was at Felton?
Felton Borstal. Yeah, before the new build the old one. I remember the first night I was on call coming in and walking down the corridor and thinking, what's the noise? And it was cockroaches crunching underneath my feet.
That was a pretty horrendous place, I think.
It was quite grim, but there were good things that happened at the same time. There was some brilliant staff and some pretty dreadful goings on as well, yes.
Thank you. So we'll come on to Glenpower in a minute, but I was struck when thinking about this conversation just how much you've done in your career. So even though I'd worked with you, I wasn't aware of that. So I came to the conclusion that you were someone who hides your lamp under a bushel. Why is that?
Well, it depends what you mean by hiding your lamp under a bushel. For me, I mean, I was so passionate about TCs and prisons and it being the right way of being with people. And so I was interested in the work being out there. And there's plenty of people who can parade their egos, as you know, David, we all know. And I just find it quite tiresome. I stopped listening to them. And I remember thinking, I want to try not to be like that. I suppose all of us have part of ourselves that are, you know, a little bit self-aggrandizing. But I really wanted to keep a check on that side of my personality. So if that's the case, then I've been successful.
Well, that's very interesting because we were talking a few weeks ago, we were talking with Mikhail about his work, and we did reach the, to say it was a conclusion is a bit overstating it, but we did feel that sometimes we observed colleagues who showed off a lot, and we were all uneasy about that. So you later then began to work at HMP, it wasn't HMP, was it? It was Young Offenders Institute, Glenpower. How did you get there?
HMYY then, yes.
Yes. How did you get there?
Originally a law school. I'd finished my rotations and I wasn't sure where I was going because I was disillusioned with a very organic psychiatry school, and they were disillusioned with me. So, I mean, we were headed for a clash, no doubt. And I was kind of looking around, and I was offered a job in Glenpower. So they said, you can come and you can have a unit all to yourself to do what you want with. Who could resist? So that's what I did. I went down to Leicester. And stayed there ever since.
So was it you who started the therapeutic community at Glenpower?
At Glenpower, yes. Yes. And what happened to it?
Well, you can tell us something about it.
Well, this was...
You see what I mean? You see what I mean about hiding your lamp under a bushel? You can tell us all about Glenpower.
Oh, well, because it's no accolade to me. It's entirely my fault, unfortunately. When I left and went down to Aylesbury, young offenders, ostensibly with the idea of, I was going to do the same, I underestimated the importance of having to have a strong voice in the senior management. And there was nobody who was going to stand up for the TC once I'd gone. I hadn't realised how much I used to stride around shouting, and there was nobody to do that. What was left was the prison officers. And in those days, I don't know if you remember, you will remember, of course, prisoners They took what society couldn't manage, well, they still do, and they expected prisoners to be treated badly, and therefore staff were treated badly, and it was kind of kick them all the way down. So these poor prison officers were there trying to hold up the candle for a therapeutic community in the midst of what was a huge establishment, and nobody there to help in senior management. So, I mean, they just got dumped on from a very great height.
Judy, could you just say a bit for our listeners about why that happens, in the sense of if you've got people who are viewed quite contemptuously by society, why that then might mean that the staff also find themselves treated quite badly?
Well, I think the whole establishment becomes tainted by the view of society of prisoners. People would rather not acknowledge the humanity, because it would mean that they would have to acknowledge their own culpability in so many areas, their own similarities to prisoners. In fact, when I retired and my husband retired, I remember him saying, I thought all the bad people were inside, locked up. But no, they're all out here. And he was quite right. He was quite right. So there's a kind of move to say, we don't have to think about it. We don't have to face it. We don't have to examine it. Or locked away. And therefore, we can do what we like with it because we're frightened of it. And so we can kick it about. That's my view. Does that sound too simplistic?
No, there does seem to be some kind of contamination effect, doesn't there?
Yes. That's one way of putting it, yes.
Thank you. I was going to say, Judy, how would you put it?
Well, again, I'm just reminded of being in Feltham when you said contamination effect. And we had a visit from people from the Royal College of Psychiatrists. And they came round and, you know, I was showing them round. And they were very dismissive and very negative. And one eventually said, well, what do you do? You know, how come you're here? And I explained I was on secondment from the rotational scheme in Manchester. And they changed completely. Oh, we're suddenly interested in what you've got to say now. And it's as if people dare not consider that anyone associated with the dark side might have anything useful to offer. But when we were starting to plan the accreditation documents, I remember Kirk laughing at me and saying, I said, it's important to look for the gift in the dark. And I think if we don't look for the shadow, if we don't look for the dark side, then it comes back and bites us. And that's what's happening now. The more we try to lock it away, the more dangerous it becomes.
So thinking about the gift in the dark, Judy, can I take you back to Glen Parva? Because you rather kind of slipped past that. How did you have the idea of starting the therapeutic community?
I just thought it was the right way to be with people. I wasn't into anything fancy about therapy the way people are nowadays. I just thought people collective emotional experience, if you like, if they were treated right. No, that sounds very naive. If in an environment which enabled them to look at themselves in a culture that encouraged it and helped them make sense of it and confronted them when it went wrong, then things could change. And those seemed all the elements of a TC, which I'd already experienced with youngsters in the NHS. And so I wanted to do the same for these kids who didn't have a chance in the prison service.
So where did you get the idea from?
Well, I'd already worked there. I mean, it wasn't my idea. I'd worked with Peter Wells in the Young People's Unit in Macclesfield. So it wasn't a new idea. I went on to work with Bob Hobson in Duskell House, who had looked after that beautiful TC in London, whose names escape me. But anyway, so that's where I worked. Lucky enough to work with people who shared their experiences.
Okay. I was harking on it a little bit because we know from speaking with Roland Woodward some months back that that's where he met you, and that's where he got the spark for working in and then obviously creating therapeutic communities in prisons. So it seemed like an important moment in time, perhaps.
He was already working in Grendon when he came up to Gartree. And yes, we met when I was looking after Clem Parver. But I think where the spark happened was that he and I and Eric Cullen started the first meetings that supported people who were working in TCs and prisons. So, you know, things like the therapy group, the TC therapist meetings, those kind of things happen nationwide then. And we hosted the first of them. So quite pleased about that. That was non-Bushel making.
So that was when you were working at Grendon, was it?
Glenparva, no, I was at Glenparva then. And he had been working in Grendon and moved up to Gartree and used to visit because, I mean, they were both in Leicester, Gartree, or near enough Gartree and Glenparva. And so we got to...
Okay. So after Glenparva, you worked at the TCs in HMP Grendon, Gartree and Dovegate, which is a remarkable, I was going to say, it's a remarkable record. So if you'd be able to describe that time for us briefly.
Quite difficult to describe, really. I was determined I wasn't going to work full-time for the prison service because I had realised that once you are beholden full-time, then they've kind of got you. You know, they're in charge of your mortgage, they're in charge of your job and your future, and if you see something that you really can't stand, it's difficult to stand up and say no, because, well, too much hangs on it. So I was determined I was going to stay as visiting psychiatrist as I was then. So I went first to Aylesbury for young offenders before Grendon, and opened a small TC there. But I was also visiting as a psychiatrist to other prisons. I think I mentioned 13, 14 in all. I'd been visiting psychiatrists too. But yes, the TCs, Grendon and then Dovegate and Gartree were the main ones, I think. But that time, you see, was a time of threat because the Max Glatt had been closing or was closed. People did not like therapeutic communities in the health service, and in the prison service, financially, they were difficult to justify, people said. So, yeah, I just moved around where the work was.
Despite that, though, Judy, with the exception of Glenparva, you know, three of those TCs are still operating. Grendon's been going for about 60 years, Gartree for 30, and Dovegate for 20 years. What do you think's helped them survive?
I think the reason that Glenparva didn't, as I said already, was my fault. You know, I didn't give it a strong enough root in the senior management group. I hadn't realised the importance of that, how much they needed kind of defending, if you like. What helps them survive? I think the bigger ones, Yes, I think there would have been too much of an outcry had anything happened to close them or try and close them. And by then, of course, we had accreditation. So there was starting to be something that was recognised as impacting on offending. And yes, it would have been more difficult in those days. I don't think they'd have closed Glenfarva now as easily as they did then.
So you're obviously really passionate about therapeutic communities. What are the things that you think work well in a TC?
Not being too precious. This is right off the top of my head. Not being too precious. The acknowledgement that we all have something to offer, that no one is better than anybody else, that you can't end up saying, and this is where I think some of them have fallen down. You were asking about why some didn't survive. It's difficult, unless you've got somebody on the inside, to help senior management acknowledge that at heart they're the same as the prisoners. They want to survive by saying, that's them over there, they're the bad guys, and that's us over here because we're the good guys. So what's important is that we acknowledge we're all in this together, I think. I believe that a psychodynamic approach is important. It helps us understand that there's a lived experience amongst the staff team. So when they've been there and done that, it isn't just in the head. It's a heartfelt knowledge of what it's like to go through some of the difficult times. Structure is important, obviously. Probably that's it. And nothing too fancy, you know?
Judy, it's interesting that you said about therapeutic communities not being too precious, because I think one of the criticisms that has been there about therapeutic communities, TCs, is their lack of willingness to change. And so clinging on to using a model that, you know, all interventions are in either small or large groups with a prohibition of individual work. I just wondered what were your thoughts about the idea of doing supportive individual work to help people manage to bring things to group settings?
Yeah, I don't like the word prohibition at all. And we always included individual work. I think all that matters is that it is fed back into the large group. Otherwise, what happens is it gets split off. I'm sorry, this keeps sliding off my head now. The material gets split off and can be used in a negative way. So yeah, I think TCs are a broad church. You know, we don't have to stick rigidly to a model, but there are features of that model that are essential, like the large group, like everything being fed back. But other than that, I wrote a paper. I do have a book, which is not a very erudite book, but it's called Trust and Change. And it does have a chapter about how you don't have to have anything very special. But the, I'm trying to think of the right way of saying it now. It's like the techniques are the icing on the cake. And the techniques are what people get off on. And they say, oh, well, we can be a something kind of a therapist, another kind of a therapist. But the cake is the community itself. And that's what matters. You can put any kind of icing on it. You can put pink icing, chocolate icing. You can have psychodrama. You can have art. You can have outdoor activities. It's the cake that matters, and some kind of icing to help people think they know what they're talking about. None of us do, really.
Yeah, I think I'm inclined to agree with you. I think that sense of community and belonging, sadly, doesn't get the same visibility, even though that seems to be the thing that's really important about work in any kind of residential setting, really, and there's far too much competition about therapeutic models, which you've captured quite nicely there.
But you can't measure it very easily. That's the problem.
Yes, it'd be, that's a lot more complex, isn't it, than sending someone to so many sessions of something. Compared to a hospital setting, prison TCs function on a shoestring and with very restricted staff. And of course, there isn't any spare money in the criminal justice system. But do you think more staff would make a significant difference to effectiveness?
I think it's much, much better that they don't have as many staff as the NHS. Probably be shocked for saying that, really. The TCs I worked with in the NHS, I mean, the first one, there were four times as many staff as there were inmates, prisoners, patients, whatever you wanted to call them. Four times. That's an awful lot of staff. And that meant that the staff, all 20 or 30 of us, used to spend hours and hours and hours in groups trying to process and take everybody's opinion into account. Meantime, the half dozen youngsters that we had were running riot outside because we were too busy thinking about our own stuff. No, I'm not in favour of more staff. I think I've said enough about that. I mean, obviously you need to have enough to do the tasks, but I think they had it about right. And there's certainly more than in the ordinary wards than the ordinary landings.
Judy, in the book that you co-wrote, Dove Gator, Therapy Community in Private Prison, it's a very interesting book, actually. You describe very powerfully the schisms and destructiveness that can develop in prison TC senior teams. And that was clearly your experience at Dovegate. But I think also we experienced it at Grendon. And I also experienced it at Millfields in East London. So it does seem to be a feature which can readily emerge. Do you think it's inevitable?
I think it's inevitable if there isn't a culture of helping people process what's projected into them from the people they're dealing with. And I think that's what it's about. Yes, if there isn't a psychodynamic, if there isn't a culture that says we have our issues, then what happens is that the staff, the management, whoever's in charge, have to maintain the moral high ground. And that means they have to keep either the prisoner or the patient in the sick role. And that's working against them getting better or getting out. It's only by ownership of our own material that we can actually make a difference. On the individual level, it's by ownership of the shadow. And that means many people aren't going to want to work in that kind of environment. It's difficult. It's scary. It's certainly scary.
Absolutely. When I worked in the FENS unit at Whitemore, where we offered a lot of group work as well as individual work and also large groups, But in the senior staff group, when we were making decisions and meetings, there'd be quite open disagreement. You know, people would discuss things and things could get quite heated. But that felt fine because we liked each other and it felt like we were having open disagreements. But for new staff, that could be quite scary, I think, to come and see that, oh, people are not all saying the same thing, not all agreeing with one another. But can you identify any of the things that are needed to avoid those kind of conflicts and tensions arising in teams, because ultimately they can end up being quite destructive, can't they?
Well, they can. I'm not sure that one should avoid them. It's what happens when they emerge. It's that they are then worked with constructively and used as kind of manure to fertilise the ground, if you like. Not that you say, oh, well, we'll make sure they don't happen. They're bound to happen.
Yes, yes, you're quite right. So, Judy, I was really interested to read that you're a psychosynthesis psychotherapist. I have no idea what a psychosynthesis psychotherapist is. Would you mind explaining for me and also for the benefit of listeners, what are the features of the model and how do you use it in your work?
Well, it's like any other psychotherapist, really. But it's one of the transpersonal groups of psychotherapy. It's quite heavily based on Jung, designed and spoken about by Asa Gioli, Italian psychotherapist. And yes, as I say, heavily based on Jungian. Jungian thoughts and models, but also has some specific models. So because it's transpersonal, it will try and include the transpersonal element. So it sees symptoms as, presentation of symptoms as not being pathology, but speaking about the state of the soul, if you like. And that's what you would look at. And also one of the key things that I used to love with it was subpersonalities, which is essentially the different parts of ourselves and has really taken off and very fashionable at the moment with internal family systems. But it's bigger than that, but it included that years ago as well. But other than that, the principles are the same as.
Thank you. And finally, Judy, it sounds like you've worked in some really challenging situations during most of your career. I mean, it can take its toll working in the prison system. How have you looked after yourself and kept yourself emotionally balanced over the course of your career?
I don't know if I have. I think that's probably a matter of opinion as to whether I have or not. I think how I looked after myself mostly, the two main features that have contributed to the way things turned out and kept me okay, I think, well, partly my husband, who's unfortunately dead now, but yes, at the time he was an enormous support. And we lived on a boat. So we were continually surrounded by nature and a different way of life to the cut and thrust of the city life.
Thank you. That's really interesting and a fascinating answer in terms of the choice to live on a boat as being the solution.
Well, don't know if it would be for everybody, but it was for me.
Thanks very much, Judy. I'm back.
Thank you very much for asking me today. I hope it's been...
Do you think you've said everything you wanted to say?
No, I never have. But you don't want me to go on all night, do you?
Well, I think David's right. I think there is a sense of hiding your light under a bushel. So you've clearly done so much and been really instrumental in so many really important services. But there is a sense of you kind of like in the interview being a bit will-o'-the-wisp and disappearing when actually you've obviously got so much knowledge and experience that maybe you're a bit too humble.
Well, I think I mean thank you. Come and write my biography. How about that?
Good. Well, thanks very much. I agree with Naomi.
Thank you.